You're listening to the Allan Gray Podcast. I'm Sipisihle Zwane, a portfolio manager at Allan Gray, and your host for this episode. Some of the most successful investments in history have come from owning businesses that can compound value over long periods of time. Our team of analysts tries to identify these businesses, waiting for opportunities to invest in them at valuations below our assessment of fair value. In today's conversation, we explore how we at Allan Gray think about finding businesses with the potential to become long-term compounders. We also delve into how our judgments of intrinsic value can evolve as those businesses grow, mature, or change. We'll unpack the characteristics we look for, the role valuation plays even when investing in exceptional companies, and how we approach the difficult question, when is the right time to sell? Joining me today to explore this topic are fellow portfolio managers Chetan Pillay and Peter Kwanov. Chetan and Peter, welcome to the podcast. Maybe just to start, we talk about these higher quality compounding businesses, you know, the things that, depending on which study you read, less than 5% of companies in the market contribute most of the equity returns and they compound value over very long periods of time. I mean, in theory, you kind of can figure out what are the metrics that matter. So, you know, you could run a screen and then go away for like 20 years and let the screen do its work. So in practice, I think I'll start with you, Peter. What makes it quite difficult to actually identify and hold on to these businesses over long periods of time?
So I think what makes it particularly difficult is usually when a company is very high quality or business is very high quality, that's quite clear to people. Everyone knows what most of the factors are. And that tends to mean that you have to pay a very high multiple of earnings or a very high valuation in order to buy that a share in that business. The issue is then, if you pay a very high multiple, the risk of the future disrupting that business model one way or another is high. And that could happen through technological change, that could happen through regulatory change, changing consumer behavior, or just bad luck. So there's constantly this tension between, yes, this is a high quality business, but if you pay too high a starting valuation when you buy it, you are exposing yourself to quite a lot of risk from an investment perspective. And getting the balance there is what makes this so particularly tricky.
That's quite an interesting thing that you talk about the valuations that you pay and paying up. I mean, if you had to listen and read things from, let's say, the 80s and 70s about investing, the big thing there was value investing, right? You pay very low multiple for companies and then what they call cigar butt investing. You pick up the cigar butt, you have one last smoke, and then you throw it in the trash. Someone else's trash is someone else's treasure in that scenario. Maybe to you, Chetan, when you think about, I guess, valuation-focused investments, which is what we try to do here at Allan Gray, versus value investments, what's the difference between the two there, and how is our approach around that, value versus valuation?
You know, I think traditionally when you think of value investing, you know, you traditionally think of buying a company for a cheap price. And generally, when we think about a cheap price, you know, Peter talked about valuation metrics, we'd be looking for something like a cheap price to earnings ratio or a low price to book value or a high dividend yield. You know, those are the traditional value metrics, you know, that value investors tend to focus on. The problem with that is you could be buying a company very cheaply, but that company could be rubbish and it could be in structural decline. And actually, I think the thing we've learned over time is that we should be far more discriminating in terms of the multiples that we're willing to pay for companies given their growth trajectories. You know, so put differently, and yes, you know, Buffett was famous for the cigar butt analogy, as you mentioned earlier, but the one thing I think we've come to realize, especially in the South African context, is that, you know, we have a subset of low quality companies that struggle to grow their earnings. And actually what you should have done is be willing to pay a very, very low multiple of earnings, as an example, for those companies. Conversely, and this maybe links into the valuation-driven investing by itself says, well, you're not just looking for cheap companies, but you're comparing the valuation you're paying relative to the growth prospects of that company. A good example is, you know, if there's a company that is growing quite quickly, and importantly, you expect that growth to be sustainable and to endure for a period of time, you probably shouldn't be afraid to pay a slightly higher multiple for that business. And history has shown that that's been the right thing to do. So I think that's the kind of difference between value investing, where you're just looking for cheap stocks as they screen on a variety of valuation metrics. But again, you know, those could be rubbish companies. On the other side of this, valuation says, well, yes, don't get me wrong, we always want to pay a low price. And, you know, the Goldilocks scenario is buying a very good company for a very cheap price. But, you know, those dislocations don't happen very often. What kind of we tend to focus on is saying, well, what are the prospects for this company? And the better the prospects, the higher the price that you're willing to pay for that business. And I think that's the difference between value and valuation-based investing.
If I can add to that, I think that's been very critical, that pragmatism has been very critical to Alan Gray's ability to navigate markets over the last 50 years for our clients, right? Because sometimes value is in fashion, sometimes growth is in fashion. I think what often happens to pure value investors is as soon as the price to earnings multiple goes above 15, they get extremely nervous and effectively they screen out those companies. I think Alan Gray's valuation-driven investment philosophy, which is different from just a pure value one, is much more pragmatic. And that means, sure, so often we try and buy a company on, say, 10 times earnings when we think it's worth 15. But we would sometimes buy companies on 25 times earnings or 30 times earnings if we think it's actually worth 40 times earnings. I think having that flexibility allows you to navigate markets that go through cycles and where there is often a lot of volatility and trends going for or against you.
And I think, you know, you referenced that stat earlier in the US, you know, 4 or 5% of companies account for basically all of the net wealth creation in US equity markets over long periods of time. I think the reason for that is because it's so hard to find enduring compounders. And I say that because, you know, your time horizon matters. Probably bringing it back to the local context, you know, if we think of the SA retailers, you know, if you just looked at SA retailers from, say, 2002 to, you know, the mid-2010s, you would say these are fantastic businesses. You know, they've compounded earnings year after year. But again, there were certain tailwinds behind them, you know, social grants, expanding public sector wage bill, you know, rising middle income consumer in South Africa, strong economy, you know, so there were several tailwinds behind these companies. And if you had just looked, you know, stopped, let's say in the mid-2010s and just looked at their track records and then predicted perhaps just based on the track record what would happen going forward, I think most people would have said, well, these are compounding businesses that are going to keep compounding for a long time. And we've seen subsequently over the next decade what happened. It's been a very tough place for SA retail, precisely because those tailwinds have abated and new headwinds have come, you know, be it competition, which again tends to erode competitive advantages over time. I think that's why it's so difficult to find those companies on a very long time horizon that are going to be the true winners and true compounders.
Yeah. You spoke a bit to it and tailwinds that are quite important. And I guess for investing as well, a business that's growing intrinsic value, the journey to almost realizing that value is much better than the business that the intrinsic value is declining, right? So if the value of the business is declining and you pay a cheap multiple for it and it seems cheap at the time, and for some reason or other the market doesn't realize it or that no one's interested in buying the share, then that business can continue to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper over time and almost erode your discounts to fair value that you bought the share at, versus one that's growing and compounding value over time and the market doesn't realize it, but the earnings are growing and the cash flows are growing. So in effect, it actually grows your discount to intrinsic value over time. So go back to the compounders, right? So, I mean, you mentioned the early 2000s, there's a growing economy. And I mean, you look at it now, what are some of the things, I guess, on a pure metric basis, if you're looking at the fundamentals, some of the things to look at or to look for in a business that could or should grow compound value over the long periods of time? What are some of the things, I know when you open the financials, when you look at the long-term history, what are some of the things that you're looking for that set, when you see that, you're like, this might be a compounder?
We try and keep an open mind. We appreciate that quality could mean different things for different companies. So you sort of need to be open-minded about it. Typically, it would be the ability to grow revenues ahead of inflation and either have a tailwind from a growing market or ability to consistently grow market share. So that top line growth is really important. The next step is then, what do you have to spend to generate that growth? Because you can grow, but if you're spending too much capital expenditure in order to generate that growth, you get a low return on capital, and that impedes your ability to grow the intrinsic value over time. So typically that could be, there are different ways to get there. So it could be you get more scale. It could be you have a higher quality product than peers. It could be you have a new technology. So there are different ways that you can shape that. And I guess then tied to that is, if you are growing your top line well and you are able to do that without having to spend overly excessive amounts of capital, so you're earning, generating good returns on capital, typically that means the business throws off a lot of free cash flow. And that's cash that's available either for reinvestment or for distribution to shareholders through dividends or share buybacks. You know, businesses get there in different ways. So you can be a Richemont who has an ultra premium product and on the jewelry side that people want, and it's just very difficult to replicate. Or you could go for a ShopRite type approach where effectively you can get the right goods at the lowest price to consumers across the country. So you've got the lowest unit costs. Either way can give you some kind of competitive moat and quite a high quality business model.
I think there's interplay between those metrics that Peter referenced. You know, for example, you know, if a company is growing revenue very quickly, there's a good chance, unless it's in a very capital light industry, that it has to invest behind that. So the free cash flow, you know, the cash generation ability of that business, as Peter referenced, could actually be quite low in the medium term because they're investing for the future. And that's okay if you think they're going to generate good returns from that capital. So, you know, the education sector, and I'm sure we'll get into this, is probably a good example of this, where there's a market where the public sector has failed to meet demand. And so the private sector has stepped in to largely fill that gap. And so, you know, these companies are growing very quickly, but they require, you know, capital into facilities, into equipment. And so, you know, that requires a level of spend that temporarily lowers your free cash flow.
Yeah.
But that's okay if you think there's a long runway ahead of them to do that.
Yeah, I like that talk about spending, I guess, and investing at higher returns. Because, I mean, when you mentioned the early 2000s and a business like ShopRite, right? So you have tailwinds of a growing overall market, but at the same time, you're growing space. So you're, you know, opening new stores, high return stores, so stores that don't impact the previous stores as well. So you keep your previous stores growing at a decent amount, and then new stores make very good profits quite quickly. So that high incremental, what we call it, an incremental return on capital. So you're spending the incremental capital quite well to increase the overall returns. That tends to make for very, very high cash flow generation over long periods of time, very high returns over long periods of time, and you should pay up for that. But I guess then the question always becomes, how long can that last and what's the runway for that growth? Maybe to talk to that to some extent, we all have businesses that we appreciate for their quality, but for some reason or other, we haven't been able to buy them yet. And it's usually valuation hasn't been ready for us yet, effectively. If you have to think about your list, I know, because I sit quite closely to both of you, and we all have lists, the companies that we're waiting to get to the right price. Can you maybe mention one of the businesses on your list, whoever is keen to answer first?
I'm at risk here of stealing Peter's example, but it's a business that I think all South African investors admire. And Peter's actually the analyst, or used to be the analyst for the stock, so I won't elaborate too much. He can go into much more detail. But Capitec, you know, it's a business that has grown, I think, beyond most people's expectations, despite an economy that has been in recent times fairly weak. You know, they've found consistently new ways to expand their profit pools. You know, just when you thought, you know, okay, they make a lot of money from unsecured lending, that's run out. You know, then they pivoted to transactional. Then when you thought, okay, well, maybe that's running out, then they pivoted to value-added services and so on and so on. You know, I think it's a business you have to admire, but then to your point, it's then, well, what are you paying for it? And it's currently trades on a quite a high multiple of future earnings. You know, we can buy other South African banks that perhaps aren't going to grow as quickly, but where the valuation discount is much bigger. So, you know, I think in a perfect world, that would be a great example of a company that I think we would like to own at the right price. But it's interesting because, and again, Peter will probably go into this, you do get opportunities to buy these companies at points in time.
I like that example. Thanks to them. I think that there are two sort of elements to your answer there that I think are sort of worth emphasizing. So the first one is that valuation discipline. I mean, even over the last 5 years, Capitec has done phenomenally well, and that's already off a high starting base. But interestingly, over the last 5 years, the share price performance has actually been aligned with Standard Bank, which is quite interesting because Standard Bank has not grown its earnings as quickly over the last 5 years, but the starting valuation was a lot lower. I think that's maybe a good practical way of illustrating to the listeners. It's fine if the business grows a lot, but if you're paying a too high starting valuation, there could be more attractive alternatives elsewhere. I think that the other thing with Capitec is the business has done phenomenally well, but you have had maybe once every 5 to 10 years an opportunity to buy back in again. So in 2013, 14, when African Bank was going bust, Capitec sold off in line with that. And actually, that was a fantastic opportunity to buy the share. You then had in 2018, Viceroy released a short seller's report on Capitec. Viceroy had a lot of credibility at the time because they'd released a short report on Steinhoff just before Steinhoff collapsed. I mean, Capitec's share price fell almost 50% in the course of a couple of weeks. And then in COVID, you had another opportunity. But the problem and what makes it so particularly difficult is when the share price falls like that for a high quality business, it's usually because there's this big, big question about, you know, has the business model broken or has something fundamentally changed? And I think at Allen Gray, there are a lot of disadvantages to being big, but one of the advantages which we try and capitalize on is even if we don't own a share for our clients in the portfolios, we still do research on it because you never know what's going to happen. So even though we don't have a lot of, say, Capitec in 2013 when African Bank started going under or in 2017, because we'd already done the research and we knew the company, when the share price fell, we could react quite quickly and capitalize on that. But that's really hard. I mean, something like Clix, for example, has been on my list for ages, but it's been trading on over 30 times earnings. And it's a great business. But now suddenly the share price has come under a lot of pressure. And are you sitting here going, okay, well, has something fundamentally changed? Or is this actually a generational buying opportunity and you should be piling in? Having done the fundamental research is the only way that you can actually distinguish those two. So the cyclical versus the structural. And that's hard.
I always laugh about the list, right? So we all have a list of these businesses that we want to buy. And then when the moment comes, the price is never the price. No. And you always have to relook the price and think about it again. But I guess that's the advantage of having this very deep fundamental research that looks longer term than the short term noise, right? So I guess people worry about clicks now, but it's like earnings are still growing mid digits, maybe high single digits, which is still much higher than most businesses in South Africa, and the multiple is halved. So then the question is that longer term, the fundamental growth engine broken. And I think that takes some work and some thinking, but sometimes just a half of results doesn't mean, you know, the overall fundamental case is broken. And if you have a longer term view and a more fundamental, deeper view, sometimes you have patience and you get to buy in those opportunities.
I think it also, you know, it comes back to a fundamental tenet of free markets, that excess returns effectively almost always attract competition. Mm. And so it's why, you know, when what is perceived as a quality compounder compounds for a long time and that algorithm starts breaking down or even shows signs of breaking down, people start questioning it because it's completely irrational for somebody to come in and start competing against that. And I think it's a little bit of what you're seeing now in the kind of pharmacy and drug sector in particular, where there's this risk of competition coming from outside the sector that is potentially at risk of disruption. It's something that it's very difficult to get away from in a completely free capitalistic market. Mm-hmm. It's often why you tend to see outsized returns from protected markets. Yeah. It's why we look for, you know, again, to kind of borrow from more famous investors than us, you know, when we're looking for moat, you know, again, you're looking for, can something sustain itself? It's often because there's protection around it, you know, and that can be from a variety of ways. That can be market structure, that can be regulation, that can be capital intensity, you know, that can be from a variety of things. But, you know, absent moat or protection, it's very hard for a company to earn outsized returns indefinitely.
I think what also makes it difficult is that if the overall market isn't growing and people are making very good returns, then that competition is a market share change versus, you know, everyone else can do well in the market. And maybe that's a case in South Africa quite often. So, you know, banking, it's amazing that Capitec was able to do what they're doing in a market that isn't growing that fast overall. There's been similar things in, I guess, food retail. I guess ShopRite is a popular one, but I know just then you look at Woolies quite closely, and underneath the clothing business has been a very exceptional business in the food business. How has that been able to do that well in what's a very competitive, not growing very fast industry?
When we benchmark Woolies Foods, we truly believe it's one of the best food businesses globally, which, you know, it would surprise you because it's a premium food retailer selling in South Africa, which wouldn't necessarily lend itself to that kind of outcome. But, you know, I think there are a few things that Woolies did in their food business, you know, particularly well. You know, when they were setting up the business, you know, as I'm sure listeners are aware, you know, food retail is a game of scale. And in order to build scale properly, you really have to set that up at the outset. And so what they were able to do quite well, you know, a few things, they were able to secure quite attractive locations, and in particular convenience locations where they didn't just go to the big super regional malls, but actually, you know, you see lots of Woolies Foods in lots of kind of convenience centers. And that was a deliberate strategy to kind of capture the smaller basket daily kind of shops. The other thing that I think they did really well was, you know, they focused on product excellence and product leadership. Now, if you think about broadline food retail, if you've got commoditized products, you're effectively competing on the channel, i.e., you know, if I'm selling a generic box of cereal, you know, it's not the cereal that matters, but it's the price and where's the thing located. Woolies went slightly differently because, you know, 90% of their product is what they call private label. And all that means is it's Woolies branded. It's not branded by a third party producer, even though it may be made by a third party producer. And so the result of that, you know, focusing on product excellence and product leadership meant, yes, channel was important. You know, you needed to be in the right place, but having the best product is what you led with. And I think that's why they did really well and carved a niche out for themselves, you know, away from the mass market retailers. And then they set their supply chain up, secured the suppliers down. You know, it was some very good early on thinking that I think set the business up for success.
It's probably a very difficult moat to challenge. You know, the one thing in thinking about moats is that, you know, you can have this, what seems like an enduring advantage, but sometimes technological change or platform change can actually challenge that. Maybe for Woolies, an example, I guess ShopRite and food delivery, is that a sort of technological change that has built or changed the moat? I almost think about it in food retail. Spa is an example, right? High quality business when it was growing. And I think one reason for that is that you have, you know, a big fixed operating cost base. So you have your DCs or your distribution centers across the country. And then you have independent retailers who are opening stores. So they're opening more stores, and then they're plugging in those volumes into the distribution center, and it grows overall earnings of the business quite well without having to invest a huge amount. And as soon as that stops, and one of the reasons why it's a stop is because everyone else is competition for one, but your advantage of having better locations got eroded to some extent by food delivery. Do you think that sort of that new technological change in food is a challenge for that moat?
It's definitely made a big difference. I mean, you've seen it, you know, in terms of ShopRite's sales performance versus, again, its mass retail peers. You know, I talked earlier about that channel. You know, if you're competing on generic product, channel becomes very important. Well, to your point, 60/60 and other food delivery, grocery delivery technologies have effectively eroded that locational advantage, because you can be in your home and the groceries get delivered to you. So then what's the last lever that remains is price. You know, if you're selling the same product and location doesn't matter, then you have to be the cheapest. Otherwise, you're going to struggle. Because of that scale game, you know, lower prices, you know, more volume, more scale gets lower prices, which gets more volume, which gets lower prices. You know, it's a flywheel that tends to reinforce itself. It's why I think you've seen, you know, some of the other food retailers ex-Woolies struggle. You know, technological disruption is definitely very real. The thing that I think gives us, or gives myself, a little bit of comfort for Woolies, at least on the product leadership, you know, in South Africa, we have a very limited supply base. It's very difficult to produce high quality products at scale, just given the supply base that we have. So I think at least for now, that moat is enduring. But, you know, as with everything, shortages attract capital. So it's something you have to monitor quite carefully.
I think there's always technological change, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, one of the, let's call it hallmarks or key characteristics of quality in a business is its ability to adapt to technological change. So we often see businesses come under pressure and then they blame technological change as a headwind. But we often see companies with good management teams say, actually, we are going to turn this around and we're going to use this technology as a way to go into new verticals or to disrupt or to do something new. That's not always possible. Sometimes you get dealt a bad hand and that's just it. I think there are a lot of examples of technology that initially looked like a bit of a threat, but then you had good management teams go out and go, actually, this we can turn this around and create an opportunity out of that. And that to me is also part of quality, is that ability of a management team to consistently navigate changing technology, changing regulations, changing competitive environments, because nothing stays static, right?
It's been a good hunting ground, effectively, where we've had this long-term high-quality business that's got challenged by something, technological changes generally, and then trying to make an assessment of where that settles and whether post the noise or post investment that business is still a winner effectively and if the economics have changed a lot. I mean, maybe an example of that is tobacco is one of those where tobacco economics was exceptional for the longest amount of time. The guys pushed prices out without competing too much on pricing and market share stayed stable. And then all of a sudden you have a new technological advancement in the less harmful products that, you know, change market shares overnight very quickly with regulation that was a bit behind. And then as regulation catches up, the incumbents are better able to navigate that environment. And you'd think eventually market share stabilize and they're probably better at, you know, selling the goods than the new guys. I think you mentioned, so management teams is quite an interesting one. Do you think culture can be a moat effectively? And I guess, which is a bit more tricky to assess from the outside as investors, is that something that we are able to do, we try to do, to look at culture as a potential moat for a business going forward?
Peter Drucker has a saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think there's a truth in that. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a culture that's so ingrained into the DNA of a company, you can then maybe have a slightly weaker management team following a very good one. But if the DNA of the business is doing things the right way and in a quality way, that can often outlast it. But the problem with that is cultures, it sometimes erodes slowly and you don't pick it up. And then suddenly it collapses and it turns out actually there are big structural issues in the business. And I guess the other issue with culture is it's very difficult to perceive from the outside. So we, as an investment team, often do channel checks. So if we're researching a company, we talk to people who work there, talk to suppliers, talk to customers to try and get some kind of insight. But it's a qualitative value judgment that you have to make. And that's often much more difficult than, you know, you can read the revenue growth and the margin from the financial statements. That's relatively easy. I think there's value in considering it, but it's often very difficult to get a high conviction on what's happening there. There are exceptions. Mm-hmm. So something like Amazon and Capitec, I think, are always two very good examples of they absolutely put the customer and doing good for the customer and creating exciting products for the customer at the heart of what they do. And I think that enables them to keep growing and keeping share, taking share over time. But, you know, you get other businesses that used to do that and then it starts eroding at some point or the business model becomes less relevant. It's a tricky one.
Naturally, as a business becomes larger, it becomes more cumbersome to manage.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just the journey of any business maturing. It's why it becomes so difficult to maintain culture, you know, as you grow bigger and become more successful. Because the more successful you become, the more people you need to add, the more further away you move from the founders, probably, you know. So it is a very difficult thing to maintain. But I think an important thing because, you know, I think there are very, very few businesses that run themselves.
Yeah.
You know, that put differently, I think you could have a very good business or a business that was very good, and you can have it destroyed very quickly by a poor management team or by a poor culture. And we've seen numerous examples of that that I won't mention on this podcast. But, you know, it's something that, as Peter said, it's difficult to, as an outsider, to look into, but it's something we do try to get a handle on. And you've seen it in winning companies. You've often seen them refer to this winning culture, and you often see them focus on a bit more on that side of the business, because I think they recognize how important it is. AB InBev is a great example of that in the universe that I cover. You know, a company that is relentless on a very high performance culture, meritocracy, always focusing on the best outcomes, eliminating waste, you know, a very, very efficient operating organization, and deliberate to keep it that way.
One of the interesting things when you look at South African businesses that have done exceptionally well, some of them come from, you know, similar stables, right? So, and the behaviors in those stables is sort of owner manage, not scared to invest, not scared to try out new things, thinking a bit longer term than shorter term. So, I mean, you have businesses like Consult or PSG Financial Services,
yep,
the new name, which came from a similar stable to Capitec as well. And so, you know, able to take those investments and invest in new products, take risks, or something like ShopRite and Pep, which is, you know, similar stables, effectively businesses that invest, you know, if you look at ShopRite's CapEx or capital expenditure versus most businesses, not afraid to invest. Mm. Or if you look at the financials, I think what one business that's quite similar to Capitec is OutSurance.
Yeah.
Similar returns on equity, not nervous to make investments in new jurisdictions, try new things out, and a very owner-managed sort of framework. So I think maybe that's one thing that I think is quite interesting to look for, like that owner-managed, not afraid to invest longer term. And we've seen what happens when businesses stop investing in the future. The sort of their competitive edge can fall away very, very quickly.
The one thing on that competitive edge, you know, I think it's going to be increasingly more difficult. You know, we referenced technological change earlier. No podcast is complete without talking about artificial intelligence. But I think just at the rate that things are evolving, I think you're going to see a lot more disruption in a lot more industries.
Yeah.
And so I think what we've tried to spend a decent amount of our time on is actually finding some of those businesses that AI immune is too strong a term to coin at this point in time, but at least are a little bit more resilient to just disruption risk. You know, we've done a lot of work into consumer staples, a lot of work into the luxury sector where, you know, AI is probably going to change a lot of things, but, you know, it's not going to create a handbag that's got 100 years of history behind it, or a piece of jewelry that has 150 years of history behind it.
Yeah.
If anything, it makes those things more valuable because they're more difficult to attain. So, you know, I think it's why we're trying to spend a lot more time now, knowing that actually this disruption risk is probably the highest that it's been in a very long time, finding those companies that we think are a little bit more resilient.
So I completely agree with Jathin. I think that adds to a lot of the dilemma that management teams face in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Our economy is growing at 1%. The yield on 10-year government bonds is, let's call it 8.5%. So as a company, you're probably borrowing at 9.5%, 10%.
Yeah.
So the economy is growing at 1%, and you're having to borrow money at 10% in order to invest, to grow. That's hard. That's hard to bring yourself over the line to do that. But conversely, if you don't invest, you atrophy. And competitors come in, and often it's overseas competitors like Shein or Temu coming in, say, in the clothing side or the general merchandise. Like, we often underestimate actually how difficult it is for management teams to have that conviction, to have that confidence in your business model, in your strategy, to do big investments. Like, say, PSG Financial Services, I think, has maintained very high investment in their business with success. Capitec's done the same. Yeah. ShopRite's done the same. But what makes it also very hard is sometimes you make those kind of investments and then you don't get the returns. And now suddenly you've got a lot of debt. You know, the business is the cycle is going against you, and then you can destroy a lot of value. So I think one, that emphasizes the importance of really good fundamental analysis. And two, also diversification, because you can have a very strong fundamental view on a specific company, but things happen. If it's not the war in the Middle East, then it's AI. And if it's not AI, then it's a regulatory change. So I think getting that balance right is really important.
On disruption and things like that, are there industries, I mean, if you look at quality type funds or funds that focus on higher quality potential compounders, some tend to avoid certain industries. So maybe people would avoid banks or mining companies. Do you think there's industries that, like, the industry matters a lot in finding a compounder? Like, there's industries where it's highly unlikely to find compounders?
I think industry structure is important. But I think, you know, it's important that when we talk about compounders, you know, you get, to my mind, well, several types of compounders, but the two most important ones, you get those that structurally compound their earnings year after year, right? Those, to my mind, are the unicorns, because the more you do that, the harder it becomes to continue to do that, right? Then you get a different kind of compound. And this is where there's a structural uptrend. So, you know, if I had to just plot their earnings on a graph over time, you know, if I had to draw a straight line through whatever that plot looks like, you know, it goes from bottom left to top right. However, it doesn't mean the earnings go in a straight line. Luxury goods, and Richemont in particular, is probably a very good example where, you know, luxury goods, as you would imagine, geared to world markets, to the world economy, to consumer spending. So, you know, naturally, when those things are weak, luxury spending tends to decline. But if you take a long-term view again, and you look over the space of, you know, 15 or 20 years, and you plot, you know, kind of their earnings trajectory over time, yes, it's cyclical, but there's a clear structural uptrend and a clear structural compounding that happens over time. We can apply that cyclicality on a structural uptrend to many industries. You know, you could say mining, for example, where a mining company isn't seen as a traditional compounder because commodity prices are cyclical and volatile. But you can have a mining company that's a, you know, tier one mining company with the best assets in the world and the best geographies, mining at the lowest cost. And yes, commodity prices will do what they do, but maybe they're growing production and they're very sensible on capital allocation. You know, I'd put BHP in that bucket of a tier one mining operator, but, you know, commodity prices go up and they go down. But, you know, there can be a cyclicality, but a structural uptrend that exists.
That's fair. BHP is quite an interesting one, because I think that's a business with a moat that you can't actually, it's like an incredible moat. You mine something for $20 and sell it for $100. And no one else can mine as cheaply as you, because you have an incredible endowment that's very difficult to find, and you have the logistics around that. So maybe another one in mining that I've been thinking about that's possibly on my list now, which is a change from history, is Anglo-American, which post a merger that's ongoing at the moment becomes 70 to 80% copper business. And copper is one of those where there's a structural trend and demand is rising so much and supply is really struggling to keep up with that. So you can see prices moving up quite a bit, but then the multiple has more than doubled because of that, because everyone can see it. Everyone has bought into that story. And you almost wait for that moment, you know, that little wobble that, you know, eventually comes. And in commodities, it's often commodity prices that can wobble, and you can see how that could happen in copper in the shorter term with the sort of story that copper has had in the last year, which, be it AI demand or people playing the game of waiting for tariffs to, you know, have more stocks to make some money off that. So that's one that's on my list, which is a big change from how it was a year or two ago.
Yeah, I think that ability to update your view is really important. But I think the other thing is, so I guess we've spoken about BHP as a cyclical compounder now, and then we've also spoken about some of Jathan's unicorns, so let's call it the straight line compounders. I think that's where portfolio construction becomes so important. So I think our investment philosophy allows us the flexibility to have cyclical compounders, you can have some straight line compounders, you can have some pure cyclicals, and getting the right balance there that generates, you know, outperformance through the cycle. That kind of diversification, I think, is really valuable. And having a mix of businesses that do well in different types of environments.
So, I mean, the capital intensive stuff, so mining is obviously more capital intensive, but if you're going to invest in a mine and it's going to have very good returns, then you better spend that money. So maybe to go back to Advitech, so a more capital intensive business, you know, it's just like from the outside, and you wouldn't think that a school business would have such good long-term economics and compound value so much. So, I mean, how are they able to do so well in something that's maybe not as obvious and still spending lots of money while doing it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, now actually the tertiary business is growing a lot quicker, but there's a confluence of factors that came together that I think just saw them, you know, we talked earlier about industry,
yeah.
You know, again, in a sector where the government or the public sector isn't meeting the demand for high quality education, both at a school and at a tertiary sector, you know, the private sector and Advitech is one of those companies that have stepped in to meet that demand.
Yeah.
It is a business that I think compounds reputation. Yeah. So, you know, if you think about just where most people go to school or go to university, it's because of the reputation of that school. And, you know, that's something that builds over time and is actually quite something that's quite difficult to disrupt once you've built it. It's also, you know, I think Advitech's a great example because, you know, if you look at a long-term history of its share price, you know, it always hasn't been this defensive compounder. You know, it did very well. And then they actually, you know, they lost their way a bit by some questionable capital allocation. It then moved away to a new management team who came in, focused on integrating the assets, growing organically, maximizing returns and free cash flow. And so what you've seen in the more recent history is that kind of compounding effect come together. So again, you know, a good example of the right industry, the right place, the right management team doing the right things. You know, again, the secret sauce has a variety of ingredients that made it work.
I think the other key to Advitech's success has been the capital discipline. Curo, as a contrast, maybe had a lot of the same tailwinds, so also private education, but they were much less disciplined than Advitech in terms of they just opened a lot more schools and were a lot more aggressive on opening schools and also on pricing. And Curo has not been a great investment over the last decade. Maybe that's changing now, but I think that maybe comes back to the investment question earlier. Like, yes, you want that confidence to invest, but doing it in a measured way, I think, is something that Advitech has done exceptionally well. And you can see that in their return on capital, maybe to also bring it back to what we spoke about earlier. Over the long term, having a higher return on capital from investing, but doing it in a disciplined way, that really is the sort of Goldilocks scenario, which doesn't happen that often. But I think Advitech's a great example of a company that's nailed it.
The interesting thing is that it depends on your time periods quite often. But if you look at a 20-year returns, some businesses are those compounders that, you know, as we said earlier, that drive the bulk of equity market returns. But I mean, in shorter periods of 1 year, 2 years, there is a lot of cheap shares that you can buy that you sell as they reach intrinsic value. So, I mean, having a valuation approach allows you to play at both. I guess the tricky thing is, you know, these compounders are obvious to most people. They, you know, high quality businesses are obvious to most people. We wait for the wobbles and that makes it more exciting, or I guess it creates opportunity to buy. But sometimes the wobble is actually the thing slowing down and the ability to compound breaking down completely. I mean, there's been some examples I spoke to, you know, the difficulty that Spar has had. Or a similar thing with something like a Famous Brands, that if you're growing the amount of franchisees on your fixed cost base, it helps a lot for the businesses and it there's that operating leverage. Maybe another one that was quite tricky was, you know, you had MultiChoice had some of the highest margins in linear TV globally. A growing subscriber base on a fixed cost. So you have your content spend, you know, you add an extra person, the content spend doesn't go up. So that's an amazing economic situation. But, you know, it works the opposite way when the subscribers start to come off, is that you have the fixed cost and you have the revenue going backwards. What are some of the things, and I know it will be very different in different industries, some of the things to look for when the ability to compound is slowing down? So what would be the approach when, you know, I guess it's happened now. So we have clicks on our list. It's the share price has fallen a lot after reporting half year results. So what are the things to look at and try to decide of whether it's broken forever or it's just a little wobble? I mean, one that I think about is 2018, 2019, ShopRite was struggling with IT spend and implementing that. They had lots of strikes as well. And there was a huge amount of leakage in their stores. So they had a little wobble. And then since then, operationally at least, that share has done incredibly well. So what are some of the things to look at, whether it's a wobble or the thing is broken?
So I think there's two elements to it. So the first one is, the bad news usually doesn't get priced in on day one, right? So being patient in terms of building a position and gaining conviction that the turnaround plan has credibility is really important. Mm. Tiger Brands is maybe a good example there. So 2000s, early 2010s, they probably had the best consumer brand portfolio in South Africa or close to it. All Gold, Black Cat, Cross and Blackwell. I mean, it's fantastic brands. And then what effectively happened was they had the listeriosis crisis and the share took a leg down. Mm. A lot of people then initially bought the share, but it fell another 40% from there because subsequently they mismanaged some of their categories. They had an expansion to Africa, which didn't go well. You know, you actually had this period of 2, 3, 4, 5 years in order to for the bad news to come through in time. The other thing is they had two attempts to turn it around, which didn't work, right? Which also doesn't help. So I think actually our ability to meet with management teams and have in-depth discussions with them about what is your turnaround plan? Is there credibility here? I think that's important. The other thing is then obviously distinguishing like a cyclical or temporary problem from something's permanently broken. So maybe like Spa, for example, I don't know what the answer is here. If they're poorly placed to compete in food delivery and online, that might be a structural issue. You can also argue that some of the issues are actually cyclical, like say fixing the DC in KZN and maybe the relationships with the franchisees. So being able to be quite clear about what's cyclical, what's structural, that comes from fundamental analysis, but there's always uncertainty. Like it's never clear and obvious this turnaround plan is going to work or it's not going to work.
Yeah, and especially as outsiders, by nature of being investors in public markets, you know, we're not sitting in the companies, we're not sitting in their board meetings by design.
Yeah.
The reality is that you're always an outsider looking in and you do deep fundamental analysis, but you're not going to get all of them right.
Yeah.
It's not that we don't aim to get all of them right, we definitely do, but it's just the practicality of the positions that public investors take. You know, I think the other thing, you know, we've talked about compounders a lot. There's also, you know, and these situations are rare, but they exist sometimes where there's, you know, special situations. You know, it can be a company is under a takeover offer, or you think they're going to, you know, you think their assets are structurally attractive, that there's buyout optionality. Maybe there's an underappreciated part of the business that can be monetized. You know, so again, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, we would love to probably just buy businesses that are compounding their earnings structurally over time. But I think in the South African context, in the South African environment, we are a little bit more pragmatic. And coming back to what we talked about at the onset of this podcast, you know, we're valuation-driven investors. Yes, we would love growth and we would like to pay as cheap a price as possible for that growth. But there are also other areas of value if we've identified it and provided we think we can buy that for lower than our assessment of that value, then we're also not afraid to buy those kinds of companies.
The one thing I find interesting is that, you know, if you look at, you do a little bit of finance theory, and oftentimes with a lot of the businesses that grow fast, you think, okay, maybe next year is when it slows down, or next year is when it slows down. But that extra year or two of that fast growth is actually super valuable, which changes your assessment of fair value and what you should be willing to pay, which also creates a very tricky situation in that, you know, so you buy Capitec when it falls on whatever news, or you buy these high quality businesses. Should you ever sell it? I mean, if you look at the long term history, if you're investing over the very long term, there's probably been very few times where you should have sold the business at all, even though it might look expensive, but because it's compounding value so fast, it's almost like a different way of thinking about selling discipline. How do we think about, you know, selling discipline in businesses that are compounding value very fast?
It's hard. It's the first way we think about it. So I think as valuation-driven investors, the mistake we most naturally make is to sell too early.
Yeah.
And I mean, our clients had a big position in Clicks coming out of the global financial crisis. And then after the share price doubled, we sold most of the position. And then I think it went up another fivefold from there. So that happens. I think one piece of writing I've read, which changed my thinking on this quite a lot, was Hard Marks wrote a memo in, I think it was 2021, based on a conversation he had with his son, which is who plays in venture capital, so unlisted markets. And that made me realize what tricks you in what we do is because we operated in the listed space, there's daily liquidity. So if a company does well, you can sell it every day. So I think one maybe heuristic I use is I pretend that the company isn't listed. So I own it privately and I can only sell it once every 5 or 10 years. And I ask myself, if someone came to buy my shares in this company at today's price, would I want to sell it knowing this is the only day I can sell it? Or would I be happy to keep it and only sell it in 5 years' time because I know it's continuing to compound? I think you can sort of try and isolate yourself from the temptation, from the liquidity. That actually helps.
Yeah.
That makes it a lot easier to think about, okay, how much conviction do I have that this company keeps compounding? And, you know, is the price reflective of this today? Sometimes you do have to sell it though.
Yeah.
So sometimes the share trades way ahead of its fundamentals and then that is the right call. But I think sort of protecting yourself from the temptation of being able to sell it any day, that's the really hard part for me.
Yeah, I think the last part of what Peter said echoes true with me. You know, it's a constant reassessment of what are the growth prospects ahead of this business and what am I paying for it today?
Yeah.
And that equation is going to change consistently. And when that equation becomes too expensive, you know, it's probably the right thing to sell. And if that equation still looks reasonable, despite a share having run hard, you know, it's not in the South African universe, but the memory stocks that our sister company Orbis have bought into the global parts of the portfolio, that's a great example where actually, you know, their growth prospects ahead of these companies and you're still paying a very low multiple of earnings for these companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think as long as that equation still looks right, it's probably the right thing to hold the stock. And if not, it's probably time to sell.
I think tied to that then is saying, like sort of separating this super growth or maybe there's like a short-term tailwind of one sort versus in a steady state, as things calm down, what do you think the business is generating in terms of free cash flow then? And also being quite clear conceptually about distinguishing those two, I think also helps a lot.
So with high quality businesses, effectively, we're buying shares in companies. We think, as you said, Peter, you think about like, you know, if you own the business, would you be willing to sell it versus think about it as a listed share? In your own coverage, if you could buy a business at book value. So, you know, book value, the money that's actually invested in the business, which I think to some extent actually shows what's the quality of a business, right? If you starting from scratch, you can put your own money into the business, you invest book value effectively. What business would you take at book value?
That's very easy, Capitec. It's trading at 7 times book value. So that's an unfair question. I think
insurance on a similar multiple.
Yeah, I think assurance is definitely there. And I think PSG Financial Services is also there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think those three are all companies with exceptional management teams. I think they all have very good growth runways lasting at least 5 years, most likely a lot more. And I think what all three of them have done is they've shown themselves to be extremely good capital allocators. So their ability to take that book value and reinvest in the business at high returns, I think that makes it very attractive. Now, it's not risk-free, right? Things can happen. And also, they're cyclical. I mean, banks are cyclical. PSG is very geared to financial markets and those go up and down. So I think there's also then, that's again where portfolio construction becomes important. So I'm happy to take volatility, for example, on a Capitec or a PSG Financial Services or Assurance, knowing, yes, the share price will go up and down and that's fine because I have high conviction that they will continue compounding the intrinsic value, the fundamental value of the business over time. But sometimes that equation changes and then you need to have the discipline and the conviction to then change your position.
I guess one thing is that there's a lot of smart people working in financial markets and buying and selling shares. When you're buying a share, you're buying it from someone who's selling it. And oftentimes, in my opinion, one of the advantages we have is the ability to look a little bit further than sometimes a lot of the people in the market are looking. So instead of looking 2 years out, you can look 5 years, 10 years. And if you believe in that long-term compounding, then you know those the cyclicality is actually an opportunity, which I think one of the call it wobbles, but it's not actually a wobble. But, you know, the opportunities you get to buy something like insurance, for example, is when there'll be a big hailstorm somewhere, or the, you know, there's big catastrophe type events, which increases the claims. So the margin decreases, earnings might fall. But then it also reminds people that insurance is important to have, oftentimes helps with pricing. So then it helps the top line grow longer term. And then if the top line grows, you know that they have discipline on pricing, and then the margin comes back to a normal level with more top line growth, and it creates opportunity for the business to grow. So that, I think that's one of the wobbles that I always try to look out for that business at least. So then, do you have a different answer on what's the book value business you'd buy?
Jeez, I have a long list, but you know, if we were talking about the 1980s, where, you know, on balance, the market was a lot more capital intensive than it is today. Yeah. You know, book value, or effectively the equity value that a company carries on its balance sheet, became far more relevant. You know, because it had to spend capital every year, and that was reflected on its balance sheet. But as you've had these capital light tech companies that have emerged, well, maybe not so capital light now with the AI spend that they're doing, but, you know, book value almost became immaterial because they were generating far more value than their book value would imply. So yeah, I know, I've got a long list.
So I completely agree with what the two of you said, but it still remains hard. Something like transaction capital, for example, a lot of what I was saying now about Capitec, PSG Financial Services, and Archerance was true about transaction capital. They did phenomenally well for about a decade, and then it imploded because they'd overextended, and they were, I guess they'd probably taken on undue risk. And I think that again emphasizes, like, you need to be on top of it. There isn't any room for complacency and just sort of saying, oh, this is buy and hold, and you forget about the share for 20 years, to what Tristan was saying earlier. Even if it is high quality, you need to be constantly reassessing, are regulations changing? Have they traded ahead of themselves? Are there new tech or new entrants that are potentially disrupting this? And even if you do that, it's still hard. Like, you still get it wrong quite often.
And maybe to put my optimist hat on, the one thing that sometimes helps is trying to think of what are the blue sky opportunities. So what is the things that are not obvious in the share price now? And oftentimes, if the business has good capital allocation, they can create those opportunities. And, you know, when these businesses trade at high multiples already, there almost has to be, to help the valuation, the ability to add on products, so like, or to grow, that's not obvious. So in the Capitec example, we know that generally they'll release a new product or go into a new space, and that grows quite fast. And then they constantly thinking and assessing what's the next space to grow into, and have that quite well over time. In the insurance example, it's like new markets, right? They opened in Australia, looking at Ireland now. So you know that they have the ability to actually assess and start new businesses. Is there any business in the portfolio that you think might have a hidden blue sky opportunity that's, you know, possibly worth paying up a little bit for?
I think it's hard because management teams, when they see an opportunity, usually put it out there very quickly, right? So so usually if there is some kind of a blue sky, management teams of companies would put it out there, and then especially if the market's a bit excitable, which it tends to be, then immediately, you know, it starts pricing in. Not only have they already executed on Ireland, say, for Archerance, but in fact, they've already taken 20% market share. That sometimes happens. I think we typically look for companies where the market is taking a too pessimistic view of it. And then often it's actually easier to say, oh, wow, not only do we think there's a recovery in their business, say, currently, but actually there's this or that opportunity which the market isn't even considering because it's completely lost faith. Off the top of my head, it's just hard. Businesses are competitive. I don't see something like that. And I was probably wrong on Capitec in terms of like how they've been able to branch out into business banking, I think, very effectively at very low cost and getting very good penetration. That's exceeded what I thought was possible, for sure.
That brings us to the end of episode 36. Thank you, Chetan and Peter, for joining me. Thank you for listening. Some of the key takeaways from today's discussions are that there are few businesses that compound significant value and drive most long-term equity market returns. The best opportunity to buy these businesses is often the most uncomfortable. And finally, time is the friend of the compounder. It helps to buy a wonderful business at a fair price. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to podcast@alangray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Sipesihle Zwane. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcast.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.